This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Crime and Punishment. It's not just a Dostoevsky novel. It's also a very real issue that's unfolding in courts around Wisconsin.
When a defendant is convicted of a crime, he or she goes in front of a judge to be sentenced. But the story does not begin or end there. Beyond the judges, there are many actors affecting what happens to that defendant before, during, and after sentencing, from legislators to electors and parole boards to corrections departments.
Professor Michael O'Hare teaches criminal law in Marquette University Law School. He says his interest in Wisconsin's sentencing policy development was piqued when he moved to Milwaukee in 2000, right during the state's implementation of Truth in Sentencing, a massive paradigm shift in Wisconsin's criminal justice system.
His interest and research has culminated in a book, Wisconsin Sentencing in the Tough on Crime Era, How Judges Retain Power and Why Mass Incarceration Happened Anyway. He explains to Lake Effect's Bayon Silver the mass incarceration trend in Wisconsin that started in the 1970s.
The prison population in the state had been very stable for many years in the 60s and early 70s, right around 2,500 inmates. And then beginning in 1974, we had a jump above 2,500. And every year after that, for 30 years, the prison population increased. Finally, the population peaked in the mid-2000s. And for the past dozen years or so, it's been pretty stable, moving up and down between about 22,000 and 23,000 prisoners. So that period of great growth in the prison population is over now, but we have stabilized at a level that's about 9 times higher than the historic norm.
And you cited the UW-Milwaukee study in 2013 that said that Wisconsin had the highest incarceration rate for African-American men, and that a majority of Milwaukee's black men in their 30s and 40s were either in prison or had been to prison. But your book is not really a sociological exploration on the factors that account for this, poverty, racism. It's not really about that. It's more a look into the political forces and the policy. Is that how you'd characterize
it? Yeah, that's right. And I talk a little bit about the issue of racial disparities in the book. That's a really important issue. And I do try to get some ideas down about that. But it's a very complicated issue. And you're right, it requires a much more extensive sociological study than I wanted to undertake in this book. It would be a terrific subject for a separate book in its own right.
So one of the things that this book really focuses on is sentencing policy. And you mentioned Truth in Sentencing earlier. Can you just kind of explain what the big differences are between what was going on in the 70s with parole and what we have today with Truth in Sentencing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that the Truth in Sentencing law was the single most important legislative development in the entire time period covered by the book. Prior to Truth in Sentencing, Wisconsin, like most states, had a parole system. And if you go back to the 1970s, we had a parole board that was empowered to release most prisoners in most cases after they had served as little as 6 months of their sentence. So a judge might pronounce a sentence of 10 or 20 years, and the parole board could, in theory, release them as quickly as the six-month mark. Now, in practice, that didn't happen. The parole board would normally want to see more of a period of good performance in prison before releasing somebody. But still, the parole board had this tremendous amount of discretion over the length of prison sentences. Parole board would pretty often release offenders somewhere around the 50 to 60% mark of the sentence. Normally, they would have to be released by the two-thirds mark at the latest. And then the balance of the prison term would be spent in the community with limited liberty and subject to supervision by parole agents. But there was a big political backlash against parole in the state in the 1990s. And that played into the adoption of the Truth in Sentencing law. The Truth in Sentencing law took away the possibility of parole release for all offenses committed on or after December 31st, 1999. Now what happens is that the sentencing judge pronounces an initial term of confinement. The offender will serve that period of time and then will go into extended supervision, where there is an agent who's responsible for keeping an eye on the offender. There are lots of conditions convictions, and the offender can be returned to prison for the balance of the sentence pronounced by the judge if the offender breaks any of the rules. That revocation process has been a very important part of the mass incarceration story in Wisconsin for the last 10 or 15 years.
Because the longer that you're on supervision, the more chance you have to make a mistake of some sort, whether it's using drugs or getting caught in a traffic stop or something like that. So then people get revoked and sent back to prison, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this high number of revocations that we have right now in Wisconsin really is a very predictable legacy of the huge surge in the number of people going into prison in the 80s and 90s, because in this state and in every state, the vast majority of people who are sent to prison are released at some point in time. There are relatively few true life sentences. So those people will get out eventually. And so the more people you put in, that means that a few years down the road, the more people you're going to get out. In fact, in recent years, most of the people going into our prisons have been sent because of revocations, not because of the commission of a new crime and the imposition of a new sentence.
That's amazing to me. You know, the thing is that with truth in sentencing, it added all this discretion for the judiciary, but that's not the only concept at play here. You write in your book about the competing concepts of populism, managerialism, and judicialism, along with there's a fourth consideration, penal egalitarianism. Can you describe what those attitudes towards crime and punishment are?
Yeah, sure. And the populist position is really the tough on crime position. It's the view that there's not much that we can do with criminal offenders besides just warehouse them. So there's no confidence in rehabilitation and no confidence in the discretion of criminal justice agencies or judges. So classically, the populist would most prefer to see mandatory minimum prison sentences. The managerialist position is one that places much more emphasis on the rehabilitation of offenders, and this position is more focused on cost and using limited criminal justice resources in the most cost-effective fashion relative to public safety. The judicialist position is one that really emphasizes the discretion of the judge and that really sees the judge as the pivotal player in determining punishment. The judicialist position doesn't really take a position per se on tough on crime versus rehabilitation and second chances, but instead the judicialist position is leave it up to the judges. Let the judges decide case by case based on their own views and based on the views of the community in which they are serving. And the egalitarian position is the one that I really don't find represented very much in public discussion of sentencing policy in the state, but then the view here is that the criminal offenders should be viewed as fellow citizens. We should really try to minimize the restrictions on their liberty, the deprivation of rights that they suffer, and get them returned to the community as quickly as possible. We should also try to involve offenders and offenders' families as much as possible in determining how a correction should be administered in the state.
Well, and when you look at trends like the trend of increasing mass incarceration like that, you're looking at the tension between these policies. And you wrote that if the book had been written precisely at the millennium, its overarching story would have been the triumph of the penal populism. But you said that the real story of Wisconsin sentencing policy is kind of illustrated in a Slovenian painting that you received
right.
from your family. So if you could explain what lessons there are to be learned from that.
Yeah, sure. Again, as you say, I think that up to about 2000, the story really is one of populist triumph. Since 2000, managerialism has been coming back in the state. You can see that, for instance, in the dramatic proliferation of drug treatment courts in the state. There's definitely more interest in rehabilitation in the state and more funding being made available for rehabilitative programming. So I think overall, you can see over the decades, just a constant sort of push-pull between populism and managerialism in the state without one side really getting a decisive victory over the other. Now, the Slovenian folk art that you mentioned, it's maybe kind of a complicated analogy, but the image is of a cow, and there are two farmers who are having a dispute over the cow. One farmer is at the head of the cow and is pulling on the head, and the other farmer is at the tail of the cow, pulling on the tail in the opposite direction. And in between is somebody who is milking the cow, taking the milk for his own benefit. And the caption to the picture explains that that's the lawyer. So the lawyer gets the benefit. The lawyer milks the cow as the parties are fighting over who owns the cow. And that's a little bit of an exaggerated sort of image to use for the Wisconsin story. But it does capture the idea, I think, that we've had this tension between populism and managerialism. And maybe the most significant impact from that tension over the long run has been that the power of the judges has increased pretty dramatically over the years. So they're, in the analogy, they're sort of like the lawyer milking the cow. Now, I don't mean to suggest, though, that there's some grand conspiracy theory here and that the judges collectively set out to maximize their power over the years. But that's effectively what happened.
Well, and you wrote in the book that the averages between 2000 and 2007 of the confinement portion of sentencing went from 31 months to 40 months, and the extended supervision portion on average went from 23 to 54 months.
Yes, and I'm very glad you mentioned that statistic, because that really shows you the true effect of truth in sentencing. It wasn't so much with an extension in the initial amount of time that people were serving in prison. The most dramatic impact was on the back end, the amount of time that people would be on supervision in the community after the initial release from prison. And that matters an awful lot because, as we've already discussed, many of those people will get revoked. And the longer their period of extended supervision is, the more likely it is they'll be revoked. So that increase in the amount of time of post-prison supervision is sort of feeding into our prison population in significant ways through the back door.
What is the problem with mass incarceration? Like, what is the problem with society? You know, you may have someone who says, well, there's nothing wrong with being tough on crime. These people who raped someone or a robber or a burglar, they deserve to be in prison. They should be in prison. I don't have any problem with that. What would you say to that?
Well, I think, yes, when you're talking about serious violent crimes like rape, robbery, intentional homicide, absolutely imprisonment is very appropriate for those offenses. I think there are two issues to focus on. One is, what about for the less serious offenses? Do we really need to incarcerate for less serious crimes? And the other issue is, we might all agree that for these serious crimes, imprisonment is appropriate, but for how long? How long is it really appropriate to send people away for 20, 30, 40 years? And certainly one of the background concerns here is cost. Imprisonment is a very costly proposition, and we have to realize that the criminal justice system has only so many resources. So when we pour resources into imprisonment for longer than is necessary, we're taking resources away from other purposes that might, in fact, be even better from a public safety standpoint.
You wrote in the book that Wisconsin spends more on incarceration than it does on the university system.
Yes, that's right. And that's a relatively recent development. The Department of Corrections budget is higher than the UW system budget. But the money that we put into incarceration is not only coming from higher education, it could be also seen as coming from other law enforcement and public safety objectives. One thing that the research shows pretty clearly is that from a deterrent standpoint, what matters more is the certainty of punishment, not the severity of punishment. And from that, you might infer that we would do better spending money on police departments and increasing the likelihood that offenders will be apprehended rather than pouring that money into extremely lengthy prison terms in the corrections department.
Well, and you also wrote that crime is a young person's game. And so recidivism rates go down as the offenders get older. And there are certain people in the prison system serving 10, I think you said a quarter of the people in the prison system you wrote are serving 10 years or more. Is that correct?
I think that's right, although I don't recall the precise number off the top of my head. But yes, there are quite a few long prison terms. And those get to be quite expensive. The research is very clear that as offenders age, their recidivism risks do go down. And the research, at least in some states, shows, for instance, virtually no significant recidivism risk after the age of 60 for most offenders. So we can well ask, is there really much value that we're getting as a state if a person commits a crime in their 20s and 30s and we impose a sentence on them that's going to keep them in prison until they're in their 60s or 70s or in some cases even longer?
You know, of the 10 lessons that you have at the end of the book, one of them is that reforms should be grounded in ethical, egalitarian arguments and not just economics. So why is that so important?
Well, I think the economics piece is important, and that's what we've just been talking about with the costs of incarceration and the way that money could be spent on other things. But at the end of the day, I think that only gets us so far if the image that we have in our mind of offenders is of people who are invariably dangerous, depraved, animalistic sorts of beings. There are undoubtedly people in prison who kind of fit that description. But I've spent some time in prisons, and not everybody in prison is like that. There are a lot of pretty decent and surprisingly normal human beings in prison. And if we as a society can better appreciate the humanity of people who commit crimes, then I think that opens up more potential for these kinds of economic arguments. The economic arguments, I think, will only really have an impact, a significant impact over the long run, if they are grounded in a sense that the lives of people in prison are worth something. If we don't see their lives as having any value or any positive potential, I think the instincts are just overwhelmingly, well, let's lock them up and keep them there for as long as possible, regardless of the cost.
Professor O'Hare, I really appreciate you coming and speaking about this book.
Okay, thank you. It was a real pleasure being with you today.
Michael O'Hare teaches criminal law at Marquette University Law School. His new book is called Wisconsin Sentencing in the Tough on Crime Era, How Judges Retained Power and Why Mass Incarceration Happened Anyway. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mayon Silver.